Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
You can do it. Put your back into it, Chaos Kids. I'm Amber.
And I'm Naomi. This is Crime, Wine, and Chaos.
It sure is. God.
Never a dull moment around here.
Never a dull moment, you know. Well, you know, I'm back from LA and I was really vibing with the stars and, you know, Ice Cube and God, what a time to be alive.
Okay.
You know, the Grammy Museum was right next to where we were. There was just a lot of 90s nostalgia. Yeah, Hollywood.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell me about your trip.
Thank you for asking. So I went to the podcast movement, which I'm sorry, I insist that we go next time together.
I recall that you said we need to go together.
I didn't know what I was getting into. And holy shit, like at every turn I was with like Naomi and Jeremy need to be here. So I didn't know though, you know, it's like, oh, like, sure, I'll go to this thing. And then holy shit. So yeah, I've got some shout outs. So I went to the iHeartRadio party, first of all, and had drinks with this gal named Kelly Kramerick. She's fucking amazing. She's a sound designer with Wondery. Mm-hmm. And met a very cool gal named Carolyn Michaels from Victoria. She wants me to pop on up and visit her. She's a podcaster.
Just pop on up to the Victoria Island, Amber. Mm-hmm. I hear it's lovely. I've still never been.
I haven't either.
I've still never been.
It's a boat ride away. I went to the Ambies, which it's like the Oscars for podcasters.
Okay.
And an indie podcast won Podcast of the Year, and he fucking swept almost every category. So I'm going to tell you, I'm now listening to his podcast. It's called Wait For It. And it's WEIGHT. And it's just so good. It's all about like his experience moving through the world as an overweight man. And it's just so well done. And I love that so much of it is like how much he felt othered and all the missed opportunities and all the things. And then he just fucking won in like four categories at the Ambies.
That's like, awesome.
Good for you, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I met a cool YouTuber who gave me a piercing in Santa Monica. In Santa Monica. Kira Augustus. She has a channel called Weird Is Not the Word on YouTube. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I accidentally ended up in a Bridgerton Bed Bath & Body Works commercial.
What?
Well, not accidentally. We walked into this area of the mall and there's this big Netflix sign that said, by entering here, you agree to be, and they had like this whole period thing set up. And so I FaceTimed Allison because that's her favorite show and like turned the camera around. And then Michael and I just low key kept walking by like as they were shooting, like, so maybe I'll end up in a commercial.
Of course, Allison's favorite show is a bodice ripper that tracks.
She fucking loves that shit.
I bet she does.
Yeah. So that was...
That's amazing, sister.
I learned so much shit.
Super cool. I can't wait for you to mm-hmm. bring it to the table here.
Bring it.
Mm-hmm. Bring it on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about it.
You have another shout out. We have a new Chaos Kids Club member.
Fuck yes, we do. I didn't know if you wanted to do that shouty outy because he's your buddy.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Thank you so much for joining the club. I hope you're enjoying yourself.
Jeff already, love it. Jeff already made a comment on the Patreon about.
I saw that. Oh, on the MGM. Patreon? I didn't see that, but I saw that. I'm pretty sure it was Jeff who gave us another rating on the Apple Podcast app and wrote a nice little snippet about how much he enjoys the show. I know.
God, mm-hmm. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, totally cool. Totally cool.
Very
what are
cool.
you drinking, sis?
Oh, thank you for asking. It's a Cabernet called Radius from Columbia Winery.
Excellent. Columbia, local.
Local, yep.
Wineries. We've got some good local wineries here in Washington State.
Yes, we do.
So I have a crime for you.
I bet you do. Oh, that's the face of it's a doozy.
Look, I already told him I was going to do this, so he's not going to be surprised when he finally listens to this episode. I'm going to just say this right now. This is horrific.
Oh, no.
And it is all Joshua's fault. Okay.
Joshua, shout out to Joshua, who is our logo designer, but also WTF with horrific Joshua. God.
Yeah. You know what? I think, you know how I have my own kind of like niche morbid curiosities. I think Joshua does too, because it has. Anyway. Okay. I'm going to tell you about a man named Warren Barnes. Okay. And what happened to him.
Okay.
Monday, March 1st, 2021, Grand Junction police in the state of Colorado respond to a call at the Blue Heron boat ramp on the Colorado River. A wallet has been found. The woman they spoke to at the scene owned a small shop in town, Monique's Bridal. The wallet belonged to Warren Barnes, a houseless man in town that Monique had a special friendship with. She would put out a chair in front of her shop for Warren to sit in while he read his books. She said someone called her when they found his wallet down by the river, and the owner of the shop called in to report Warren missing. She told officers on the scene by the river that she had last seen Warren 2 days prior, around 5 p.m. on Saturday. She told police she had said to him, "I'll see you tomorrow, Warren." And he said, "Okay," meaning he'd planned on coming down on Sunday. And Warren never showed up. She also said it was very strange that his wallet was found where it was, because he would never walk all the way down to the river at the place where his wallet was located. Warren, I believe, was in his late 50s or his early 60s.
Okay. So it was kind of a treacherous walk or something.
It was a long way, and it was, it was not, and he never went down there. It was too far. She told police that Warren worked for People Ready. It's a place that used to be called Labor Ready. They do like temporary work placements on a daily or weekly basis. And he had worked for them for 4 years, which is how long Monique had known Warren. And whoever had initially found Warren's wallet had called People Ready to report the find, and People Ready called her. And he had also failed to show up for work, which he had never done in the 4 years that he had worked for them. This is
so everyone just knows that she's like his person.
I think that they must have known somehow. So she also told police that everything seemed to be in his wallet, although he should have had at least a couple bucks in there because she had given him $20 for beer. Monique even had a photo of Warren, and she gives that to the police to help them in their search. And when asked who actually found the wallet, she tells police it was whoever runs the free life jacket station at the boat launch there at the river. Another shop owner in town also spoke with police about Warren and her concerns about his absence, saying that she sees him every single day. He shows up at her shop before they open at 6 a.m., sometimes even earlier, and they always let him in before the rest of the customers and give him a free coffee. She said Warren was the nicest old man ever. Rough looking, but the nicest man. And they talked all the time. In fact, Warren was known all over town. Grand Junction's not a big place. I would call it like a small to medium town with about 68,000 residents. Warren was known for his, quote, outgoing personality and his love of reading. In fact, he was known as the reading man because he would sit very near Main Street and spend his day reading books. People would stop to chat about what he was reading. And if they said to him, "Have a good day," he always responded, "And you also."
Oh, I like Warren.
That same day, Monday, I think around midday, a call comes into 911 from Terry Cohey.
Okay.
She is distraught and requesting police to come to her house. She has made a horrifying discovery in her son's closet.
Oh, God.
But let's back it up, because police had been out to the boat launch Sunday morning, early hours, Sunday morning. Like 1, 2, 3 a.m., something like that. So a night and a half before, right? For a completely separate incident. Terry's son, Brian Cohey Jr., had accidentally driven his car into the river.
What?
When police arrived, he was in the front passenger seat of his parents' car. His dad, Brian Sr., was in the driver's seat, and Terry was the one outside the vehicle speaking with and dealing with the police, explaining what had happened and trying to get a tow truck out to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
After the car was removed from the water, police noticed a red substance on the bumper of the vehicle, which Brian Jr. could not explain, and it was dismissed, and the vehicle returns to the Goheys without incident. So then on Monday, when Warren was reported missing, it was actually Brian Sr. who had discovered Warren's wallet in the car that his son Brian had accidentally driven into the river.
Oh,
Brian Sr. actually owns the life jacket station thingy.
Okay. And did the police already talk to these two regarding Warren's disappearance?
No.
Okay.
These had not been connected at all.
Okay.
So this got Terry suspicious because Brian was like found this wallet. And so Terry went into her son's room to snoop around and see what else she could find. And in his closet, in a Rubbermaid tub, she found a couple of plastic bags. This mm-hmm. is the beginning of a lot of trigger warnings. Like, just you guys, this whole thing is horrific. So like, if you're not in the mood for this, like carry on, like move along. This is bad. In the first one that she looked inside, there appeared to be a human head. She took both the bags into the kitchen and put them in the sink, but she did not look inside the second bag. And before she could immediately call the police, she had to scramble to call all the parents of the kids who bring their children to her house where Terry ran an in-home daycare.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
And she tells them, family emergency, you got to come get your kids. I think there was like the kids are there.
Shit.
Yes. Yes. So it took me a bit to piece this all together. She was really careful to be quiet while she was on the phone with 911 because Brian, her son, was home at this point. He had been at a friend's house and her husband, Brian Sr., had been out. And she called him first, Brian Sr., and said, you got to come home. And then she called Brian Jr. and said, you got to come home. She didn't tell Brian Jr. why. Then she had to clear the kids out before she could call 911. So by the time she calls 911, Brian Jr. is home. Brian mm-hmm. is home. And she doesn't want him to know, like she's calling the cops basically. And he's out in the driveway or outside the garage or something like that. So she says at one point on the phone, he has had a little bit of a fascination with the morbid. He was channeling it, I thought, into becoming a crime scene investigator. But not so much.
Oh, no.
The dispatcher asked if there were any weapons in the house, and Terry told him that her son maybe had a shotgun in his room that she could go remove before he came back inside and before police arrived. Police showed up without sirens so as not to tip Brian off that there was an emergency reason for their arrival.
Also, she's running a big risk that he might not just saunter in to grab a drink, and she's got body parts in the kitchen sink.
So yes. She had covered it all with a towel, like a big tea towel was covering the whole thing. Like the bags were underneath that. Like she didn't have it just exposed. Wow. She had it all like,
yeah.
Right. So she kind of was just trying to like be chill. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Playing it cool. Oh my
God, this poor woman.
So there's a bunch of body cam footage from the cops. I watched this like hour and 45 minute ish documentary on YouTube that literally just came out recently. It already has like 11 million views or something. So some of you might have already heard the story because it looks like it's really making the rounds. But the body cam footage of this is wild because Brian's in the driveway. It's like this decent length kind of gravel drive and he's near the end of it. He might have been walking because he might have seen the cops pulling up. So he kind of walked towards them. There's two other people there. And I think one of them might be a friend of his. The other one is definitely his younger brother, Andy. At this point, too, I don't think I say this. I didn't actually write this down. Brian's like 19. He had graduated from high school about a year prior to this. Andy's still in school. I want to say Andy is like 15.
Okay.
The cop says to Brian, like, hey, your parents might have found something weird in your room. And Brian's all, yeah, probably. And the cop was like, well, like, what would they find? And Brian says, a human head and hands.
Oh, my God. What? Just
comes right out and says it. The cop searches Brian, puts on some latex glove to go inside and check things out. And Terry literally falls to her knees in the yard. She's sobbing. And the brother like stays with her to console her while Brian Sr. accompanies the cop into the house to show him into the kitchen. And the cop looks at the first bag, sees the head, like literally for like a split second, and like closes it up and like, yup, and like takes off the gloves and like leaves the kitchen, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they put Brian to the back of the cop car, take him down to the station. While he's sitting in the car, he says, Grand Junction's been quite violent lately. The cops like don't respond. His demeanor is like super emotionless.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way to the station, they pass a bridge and Brian says it was under that bridge. They put Brian in an interview room and then both Terry and Brian Sr. in individual rooms. And the police, they start by speaking with Brian's parents, right? And they're both shocked and upset and it's awful to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Sr. had been cleaning out the car that had been in the river because it wasn't functioning, right? Because it had been in the river and they were going to take it to like a local mechanic to see if it could be salvaged. And he found, like, he opened up the glove box. It was full of water and there was a huge kitchen knife in there, which obviously alarmed him.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out later, this was not the first time that like the kitchen knife had been found in Brian's car. And prior to that, they were like, why do you have that? And he was like, well, you know, just in case something happens, I need to protect myself or something. And they were like, no, Brian, like put the knife back in the kitchen.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then he found the wallet, I think like on the, in the door on the passenger side. And so he called the people ready and like told them that he'd found it by the river. He told them he found it by the river and that if they heard from Warren, Brian Sr. had the wallet at his house. So then Brian Sr. confronted Brian, who explained all of it away, right? He found the wallet and forgot in the excitement of everything else. He had no idea who Warren was. All of it was nothing. And Brian Sr., of course, wanted to believe his son.
Mm-hmm.
He told Terry that the red blood-like smear on the bumper of the car had was explained away because it was just fake costume blood that had like, he had had a container of costume blood. So Brian's like super into like horror movies. He did like some like FX, like he was super into like horror costumes and shit like that. So basically what he told her was like, mom, it's just like fake blood for like costumes and stuff. And I had a container of it and it just like burst open in the trunk.
I mean, okay.
And just like his dad, like Terry wanted to believe her son. Mm-hmm. She also told police what she had told the 911 dispatcher about going into her son's room and finding what she found in the bin in his closet. And this is also when Terry tells police about Brian's mental health history, his ADHD diagnosis at the age of 5, his antisocial behavior that started in middle school and then started to get like, and then he started getting into a lot of trouble in high school and kids didn't feel safe around him. So he was taken in for some kind of inpatient treatment slash assessment where the doctors confirmed the ADHD, autism, and recommended further testing for potential psychosis.
Hmm.
In Brian's 2-hour interview with police, after a few minutes of basic questions to build rapport, one officer asks Brian how he got here today, and Brian says, I murdered someone.
Oh my God.
The officer was actually asking him, like, how did you physically get to the police station today?
Oh, sure. He just went, he just went from A to Z, skipped some stuff.
Look, I... It's going to be a while before I forgive Joshua for sending me down this rabbit hole because I watched, they have a lot of this interrogation footage, this interview footage. I was like audibly responding to my computer screen as I'm like gasping. I'm what the fucking it's.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like much of an interrogation was necessary.
No, like- because it, they were. He, right after he says, I murdered someone, he just very willingly goes on from there to tell the police exactly what happened. Just
Oh my God.
Tells them everything.
Uh-huh.
So the night of February 27th, that Saturday night, he was driving around town around 11 p.m. feeling depressed, and he drove under the bridge or overpass and saw a figure under a blanket or a canvas of some kind and knew that it was a homeless person right there, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So he grabbed the knife, put on 3 layers of gloves, and a Halloween face mask, like literally a Michael Myers from the movie Halloween mask.
Mm-hmm.
He approached the sleeping person, pulled back his cover, and stabbed him in the neck.
Oh my God.
And Warren wakes up and he's yelling like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Get off me. Get off me. And Brian just kept stabbing him. He actually like climbed on top of him.
Oh.
Again, I'm just going to remind you guys, fucking triggers. Okay. Like at this point in the confession, Brian literally is like, can I demonstrate? And he gets on the floor on his knees and he was like, and I was straddling him and stabbing him like this. And he's like pantomiming the whole thing. It's fucking insane.
Oh, God, this guy is unhinged.
He claims the whole attack lasted a minute to a minute and a half. And after Warren breathed his last breath, Brian saw that Warren's head was already like half detached from the body from the stabbing. Oh, this police interview was so fucking rough to watch just because Brian is so clearly like he could not wait to tell someone about all of this. Even like smiling and laughing at points along the way as he's sharing these details.
Oh my God.
And not gross. In like that, like, it's not in that like affected kind of way. Like he's not playing a character. You know how sometimes you've seen those interviews, like those certain guys, they're like, you can feel like there's a force, like they're forcing some of this, like laughing and smiling.
They're like doing a shtick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is not what is happening here. This is all natural. This is literally how he is telling these details.
Spooky.
So after Warren's dead, Brian gutted him, removed his hands and his arms, collected his head and hands to take with him, stripped the body, and left the rest of Warren's body where he found it. When he got home, he put the head and hands where Terry would later find them, threw away anything from the car that had blood on it, and cleaned the knife. He washed the clothes he had worn twice, and it looks like he also wore a dark blue work jumper to go with the Michael Myers mask. It was a whole Halloween costume he'd worn the year before.
Oh my God.
He literally cosplayed like full on as Michael Myers with the fucking knife and everything.
No.
Yes.
Is he? I have so many questions. First off, is he so mentally ill that he's not even understanding that this is like reality?
No.
He's not so mentally ill?
No. There were all these things about his mental health and like diagnoses or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, like watching his interview, it's like, no. This isn't about like ADHD and autism and depression. This looks like a sociopath to me.
Sure. Like, and those diagnoses really do not result in people with those diagnoses are more likely to be victims, not perpetrators.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Oh, wow.
And I can go a little bit more into that when we get further through this. But okay. I mean, I literally cannot stress how unreal this police interview is to watch. Brian goes on to literally draw a diagram of the crime scene, like on the wall, which is like a whiteboard wall, and go into detail about where the body and the parts could be found. He talks about how he threw the arms. They're somewhere within a 10-foot radius of this spot here, and here's where my car was parked, and like here's the road, and like here's the wall. And I mean,
oh my God.
And then he talks about what he had planned for how he was going to dispose of the head and the hands. And he admitted that he was worried about getting caught, which is why he took Warren's clothes in case the clothes, his own clothes, had left any fibers behind, and that he deliberately searched out someone houseless or a sex worker, knowing that police don't care about those demographics as much.
Fuck off. Fuck off. Oh my God.
He admitted that he had been planning to murder someone for at least 6 months, and his search engine history showed searches for, I mean, so much fucking crazy shit, but like how to cope with murderous thoughts, homicidal ideation, and homicidal thoughts every day. And then, you know, other murderers, including like Andrea Yates.
Okay. That's odd.
At another point in the interview, he literally compares himself to Ed Kemper.
Okay. All right. Wow.
Yeah, he draws this whole parallel. Anyway, friends of Brian's who were interviewed about him all said similar things about Brian having like a morbid and dark sense of humor. And they all knew that he was weird, but like, that's just Brian.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Although one of the jokes in their friend circle was that if any one of them was a killer, it was Brian. But it was just a joke.
I will never get over this jokes in the friend circle of teenagers and young adults. Like, that's not a thing.
That's not funny.
No.
And it's not, that's not.
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. One friend said that when she found out Brian had killed someone, she was surprised, but also not. And that what really surprised her was that it was only one person that he killed, because she always expected that if he snapped, he would do like a shooting spree. Because he was super into that Klebold character.
Mm-hmm. 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 Columbine.
Columbine was a fascination of his.
Mm-hmm.
The police asked Brian if he'd ever killed a person before, and he said no. They asked him if he had ever practiced on anything else, and he said yes in 2018. And I'm not going to go into the details because they are fucking horrific. I will only say it was an animal. In fact, there had been rumors for a long time that Brian had done that, and someone even told police that they believed he'd been the reason for this particular pet to keep going missing in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Brian also told police he had indeed thought about shooting up his school, and also that he had pulled together a kill kit that his parents found about a year prior, and they made him get rid of it or they would call the police.
Get rid of it like they found pornos. You get rid of that kill kit. Sorry.
It was like a laundry list of items. There was like a hacksaw and like zip ties and like a hammer and rubber gloves. Oh. I mean, the list went on and on and on.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, especially his teachers, seem to think that Terry and Brian Sr. did not take anyone's concerns about Brian seriously.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of this two-hour interview, now with the information about the murder scene, other police head to the spot where Warren should be, and they do find limbs, but they do not find his body. And then they find out that Brian keeps going, that when he went home after he did this horrific fucking crime, he couldn't sleep. He'd punctured a hole in one of his gloves and was worried about a fingerprint. So he drove back to where Warren's body was. He put Warren's body in the trunk, drove down to the boat launch. He backed his car to the edge of the river on the very steep incline for launching boats, got mm-hmm. Warren out of the car, shoved him into the river, and Warren's body floated away.
Mm-hmm. But
then Brian couldn't get the car back up the incline.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a paved launch. It's just a dirt and mud launch.
Right.
And very steep. And you really need like four-wheel drive to get back up, which mm-hmm. his car did not have. And eventually his car just like slid into the river.
Oh my God.
And we know what happened after that.
Right.
So like the next day, Brian goes over to his friend's house where he told her and her husband a story about the police might be trying to frame him for murder because he had found a dead body and was messing around with it. And that's how there was some blood that got on his car.
Found a dead body that he was messing around with?
Uh-huh.
What the fuck does that mean? Like, what does that mean?
Can you
God.
What?
Just like Weekend at Bernie's? Like, what do you mean?
I don't even know.
That's not a thing. Oh my God. Okay. Wow.
The friend's husband thought that the whole story was bullshit, but he also admitted he didn't really know Brian at all.
Hmm.
And he was like, it's possible like he did find a dead body, but like he made it sound like more edgy by saying he had messed around with it or something. I don't know. But he just thought the whole thing was just a bunch of fucking nonsense.
Okay.
Was not taking any of it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So after 2 hours of this interview where Brian has gone over every disgusting detail of the murder of Warren Barnes, police still haven't been able to get a real answer from him as to why he did it. And as they ask a bit more to get to the why, the answer really came down to, quote, "For years, I was wondering what murder would feel like. You read shit like Ted Bundy and the Zodiac. They all say murder is the best feeling in the world. So I'm like, I'm going to try that.
Oh, I'm going to try that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. This guy is too far gone to be helped in any way.
At the end of the interview, when the detective walked Brian to be processed, Brian smiled at him and said, quote, "I feel like Hannibal Lecter right now."
Oh my God, that just gave me chills.
There was a section in this documentary where like five or six former teachers of his from high school all said that like not a single one of them were surprised that this happened and that they had seen the writing on the wall about Brian the whole time they taught him in school.
Wow. Wow.
There is a laundry list. There is a laundry list of incidents with this kid.
Wow.
And flags on the play for a long time.
Can you imagine? I know. No, you cannot.
I cannot.
Being one of the parents that brought their children to that daycare?
No.
I'm fucking pissed.
In one of the like clips from his dad, Brian Sr., when he's doing his interview, he's like, everything's over. He's like, Terry has a daycare. Like, that's done. I have a... like a business, like my business has my name on it. It's like, we have the same name. He's a junior. Like we have the same name. And now that name is associated with this horrific murder. Like everything's done. Like everything's mm-hmm. over now.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
In January of 2022, Brian pled not guilty by reason of insanity, which triggered a psychological evaluation. During his evaluation, when the doctors asked him how he felt about the murder, in retrospect, he responded, quote, "Yeah, it's just kind of a thing that happened. It sucks, but it happened."
Oh.
And when asked what about it sucked, he talked about being locked up, not being able to see his friends, and how he really, really, really missed video games and the internet.
Oh, it sucks for him. I see.
Mm-hmm. He had no remorse for no. Warren Barnes at all. Brian's trial was held late January of 2023. It lasted 12 days. And on February 2nd, after 2 days of deliberation, he was found guilty of one count of evidence tampering, two counts of tampering with a deceased human body, and one count of murder in the first degree. At sentencing, on the 6th of February, many impact statements were read. More than a dozen family members and friends of Warren spoke. His sister, Geraldine, who he had called to wish a happy birthday the day before his murder, she told the court since the murder, she'd been filled with a deep sense of loss and sadness because she will never get a call from her brother again. One of Warren's nieces said Brian hurt his own family, plus hurt everyone with ADHD and autism spectrum disorder. One of Warren's cousins said Warren had a thirst for knowledge and reading. She said Brian's diabolical drive to become a famous serial killer in the end, ironically, brought her fragmented family together. Another family member told the court being homeless doesn't make a person's life less valuable.
No, no shit.
She reminded them that Warren was not a throwaway person. Shop owner Monique said the hardworking man who was so giving and loved birds will never again repeat the phrase "and you also" after she told him good morning.
Oh.
And nearly every person sharing their impact statement also expressed sympathy for Brian's family, especially Terry.
Mm-hmm.
Brian was sentenced on the 6th of February to the rest of his natural life in prison. Plus 13 and a half years for good measure, I guess. I don't even know what the fuck they do that. In November 2021, a memorial to Warren Barnes was erected close to Grand Junction's Main Street. It was created by the artist Tim Navin. The installation consists of a chair shaded by a tree with a pile of books lying on the seat.
Oh, I love that. Oh, my God.
And that is the story of the murder of Warren Barnes.
That was fucking awful.
I spared you so many details. I will have a link to that YouTube documentary in my notes. So if you want to go watch the whole thing, you can see this stuff for yourself and get more details on like the backstory. It's very highly focused on Brian Cohey. I had to dig to get what information I did about Warren. I tried. As you know, I do to tell you as much as I could find about the victim of this story.
Oh my God. Well, I will not be clicking on that link. I think I've had my fill of that. God damn it. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is like in the interview at the end, he was talking about like how much adrenaline he got. And he was talking about how like he didn't enjoy it, but he also didn't mind it. He had excitement while it was happening, but it was like physical excitement.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have any like enjoyment from doing it. And he almost seemed disappointed because he really thought that he was going to get that best feeling in the world that these other serial killers had talked about. And that to me all does speak a little bit to the like sociopathy, just because it's so hard to get a rise in a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't have, like, I remember reading something somewhere about how sociopaths, like a lot of them tend to have like much lower heart rates than everybody else. And a lot of what sociopaths do is to like excite themselves to like increase their heart rate so that they can feel something in their body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what that reminded me of when he said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah, I remember reading something. I think I talked to you about it, about there's a, and I don't say this to like throw shade, but there's a high level of really stressful jobs that you will find sociopaths in, like pilots and surgeons and stuff. And that might be part of it is the...
That might be.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they are useful in some... I mean, you know, like always, that could have been channeled in such a different way, but Jesus.
Totally. Christ. I mean, there's a book I read years ago called I think it's called The Sociopath Next Door or The Psychopath Next Door. It's really interesting. It's written by a psychologist who like kind of dedicated her life to studying psychopathy and sociopathy. Well, it's the same thing, but she talks about one of the reasons why like a lot of sociopaths don't become murderers is really like a nature nurture thing. And that if they're nurtured properly or well enough, like they don't go kill people. I mean, they're still like hard people to have relationships with, and they aren't necessarily like successful in relationships in their life, but they're not necessarily like serial killers or whatever.
Right. You know? Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, Jesus Christ, sister.
Thanks, Joshua.
Thanks. No. Good God. That was
your face right now.
Dark. Yeah. No, not thanks, Joshua. Not that. Good grief.
So do you have a palate cleanser for us? Give us some chaos.
It's not a palate cleanser.
Oh,
it's not.
Shit, guys, we did it again.
Oops, I did it again. I'm calling this my final installment of culty shit that I've consumed in the last 6 months and I've just been sitting on.
Okay, great.
You know, we had the Duggars and then fucking Mother Love Bone or whatever. And now...
It's just like Mother Love, but it's like Mother God, right?
Yeah, love has won, Mother God. Yeah, yeah. Now I have for you Twin Flames.
Oh, no. You did Twin Flames.
I did.
Oh, I almost put that on my list, but I just had a feeling you were going to do that one. And I know how much you like to do the culty thing. So, you know what? I've done some dives on the Twin Flame stuff. So this is not like really unknown to me. But I do know that there was a show recently where they covered this. There was a documentary that covered
there
this recently.
Sure was.
I listened to like, I want to say it was like a 7 or 8 parter like a podcast, like a year or two ago that like dove deep into this and included like recovered /ex-members. So it was, yes, I'm.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one and the Mother God were both documentaries recommended to us by our younger sister.
Oh, right.
Where she was like, you guys.
Okay, because our younger sister does not so much enjoy the true crime per se, but she does have a little.
Oh, yeah.
Little appetite for anything culty. So
it's in the DNA.
She's got it. It's just she's a different vein for her. Yeah, sure.
All right. So first I'm going to tell you what the concept of Twin Flame is, which is actually like, it's too bad that it's ruined now, because the concept of Twin Flame originally is thought to be a spiritual or soulful connection in which two people are equally matched in their commitment to themselves, to their relationship, and to each other. So it's not necessarily a romantic relationship in its original meaning.
Right. It can be platonic. It can be a mentorship. It can be, there's lots of different versions of how a twin flame relationship can show up. Yes.
Sure. Most people know it as a soulmate, but it's just a soul connection with another human, right?
Right. Right. Which, I mean, okay.
Whatever. In its newer bullshit definition, it means that there is a person on this planet who is meant for you romantically, period.
Right, like a split apart. It's like a split apart.
Not up for debate.
Right, there's one and only one, and that's your only shot. You got to find that one.
A lot of pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this person is meant to be your intimate partner. So this concept is obviously really dangerous for people who are desperately looking to find love and feel like their life is incomplete unless they do. Yeah. So this is just prime.
There is just always another thing to add to the list of things that they want to shove down our throats from every angle that makes you feel like you're inadequate in some way and missing something in some way.
Oh, yeah.
Always.
Oh, yeah. All right. So in 2017, Jeff and Shalia Devine, and we'll get to that. That's not their real names.
No, launched, you don't say.
No. These people, they're so fucking cringy. It's okay. You
know,
anyway.
I do know. I've seen these people, or at least I've heard these people. Speaking of, I actually made my version of Chicken Divine the other day. And that actually is divine. It deserves that title. But
oh my goodness. I should do, speaking of, Allison's coming on Sunday so that we can go out and karaoke for, my daughter is turning 21 on Sunday.
Holy shit, sister. Stop it.
And I'm surprised she didn't request Chicken Divine, because literally every single time I'm having dinner with Allison, that's what she wants. Yeah, so make Chicken Divine. I'm like, you know, that's not like a whip it up thing, right?
I just sort of mentioned it to Joshua the other day, and I didn't tell him what it was called. He's like, I look forward to you making that the next time
you come over. It's so delicious. He doesn't deserve it right now after that bullshit.
He's on probation now.
He's not in the Divine Club. That is for special people only. He's on timeout after that bullshit.
Mm-mm. No.
Okay. No. Okay. So anyway, Jeff and Shalia Devine, they launched the Twin Flames Universe, which was a school for ascension to heal separation. It's an online school. Okay.
I'm going to be like on the verge of like puking and like flipping tables and like rolling my eyes every other sentence, I think, in this whole
entire thing. Yep, you will. And it gets real bad. So, okay. So Jeff was actually born Jeff Ian. And at one time he changed his name to Ender Ian Ethos.
Okay.
And Shalia was born Megan Plant. Okay. But now they're Jeff and Shalia Devine.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So Shalia says that she used to suffer until she achieved harmonious union with Jeff. Here's the other thing as an aside. You can tell that she is not in a fucking harmonious union. But they've got themselves cornered to where they can't ever split up or their whole business model falls apart. And there's no way that woman is happy. There's no fucking way. I am sorry. So Jeff and Shalia met online, and Jeff says that meeting Shalia was a spiritual awakening. I've had Chicken Divine and experienced a spiritual awakening. Yes, but
that's to be expected.
Yeah. Obs. Okay. So they met online, they have a spiritual awakening. And so they start having these classes online of healing services that they offer. And they're extremely expensive, right? And Jeff claims that he has a gift to see inside people and heal people, including cancer. Fuck right
Shut
off.
The fuck up.
Mm-hmm. And also, if they don't heal, it's because they're doing it wrong. Okay. This guy.
This is some Louise M. Hay fucking you can heal your life bullshit that is like, I can't.
Mm-mm. So then they launch what they call Twin Flames Universe online. It's not a, or university, sorry. It's not a university, just so nobody. Just
to be clear, there's not, no accreditation, yeah. Whatever the word is. It's not an accredited school, you guys.
No, it's not. You won't get transfer credits to the state college from there. I can promise you that.
No. It's like Financial Peace University.
It really is. My God. So they launched the university. Okay. God, fuck. And the university consists of YouTube tutorials, Facebook groups, along with Zoom meetings with Jeff and Shalia as the teachers and teaching people how to move through life so that they can have their spiritual awakening and thus meet their twin flame.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of these people who joined believe that their twin flame was already in their life and they needed guidance on how to get them. So basically, people had someone in their life that they were obsessed with. Uh-huh. And Jeff and Shalia were encouraging people to continue to be obsessed with them.
Right.
And some of these people had been told multiple times by the person that they were obsessed with. Mm-hmm. But of course, most people claimed that their twin flame was their ex and that they want to get them back and blah, blah, blah. Some of them, their exes were married with children already. And they were like, how do I make them understand that they are mine? Mm-hmm. So okay. Jeff and Shalia, I don't even own a gun.
Sorry. Hi, Wayne. Like, stop.
If you're not careful, you're going to lose me.
No. Oh. We were laughing, but this is so bad. This is mm-hmm. so bad. This is, oh, God.
It just gets so much worse.
They're teaching them how to like stalk and harass
people. That's literally my next sentence. Jeff and Shalia are teaching people how to be stalkers.
I can't. I love it when my sentence is your next, vice versa. Like when you're like, mm-hmm. That's literally my next sentence.
Literally. I'm not screen sharing. How did you know that? So there's even one woman in this group, you know, she's convinced that her ex is her twin flame and she stalks him so much that he gets a restraining order and she is arrested for violating the restraining order.
Okay.
And so, Jeff, mm-hmm, no, go ahead.
So now they're also like basically telling them to go and like break the law and get themselves arrested in this process.
Yeah. Because
getting their fucking twin flame.
Yes. They tell her that the restraining order is just a test to see if she has what it takes to get her twin flame.
Holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
That.
The universe is going to throw obstacles at you. And it's about perseverance and fighting for what you want.
Okay. If your spiritual beliefs are not rooted in reality and the absolute real obstacles of reality, then you're doing it wrong. That is delusional.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say, too, that this particular woman, she was employed at Stanford University as a scientist.
See, this is that thing when you're always like, I don't understand how anyone ends up in a cult. It's like because she was vulnerable. Even
yes, the smart it's people, vulnerable. Even these people are very smart.
Successful people, like mm-hmm. even smart, successful people can be vulnerable to this stuff.
Yeah. And I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, she lost her job after the arrest.
Oh, my. Well, yeah.
But she's still hanging in there. She's still going to the university, paying thousands of dollars a month. Okay. So
thousands?
Oh, thousands. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
So these are people that obviously feel less valuable because they don't have a partner and they're vulnerable and lacking emotional intelligence, despite the fact that most of them are very intellectually intelligent. It's so sad. The people that they're preying on are these people that are just lonely and feel less than because they don't have an intimate partner. So even when they're seeing red flags and problems with this, they're encouraged by Jeff and Shalia to ignore them because that's just the universe trying to derail you. Also, like this idea that we romanticize not taking no for an answer, like Pepe Le Pew, you know, that it's romantic or that it's like, no, no means fucking no.
Yep.
Period.
Yep.
So Jeff and Shalia, of course, would really drive home this idea of perseverance is romantic. And if someone says no, that's just an opportunity to look inward at how you're doing it wrong. Because that person is your twin flame and they just don't see it yet. And it's your responsibility to make sure that they see it. One of the principles in the university is that the only obstacle in life is ourselves.
Again, this is not rooted in like 3D space. This is people with like trying to achieve 5D ascension without like taking in the reality of the actual physics of the world that we fucking live in.
Mm-hmm. It's like, too, it's like I can, now that I keep doing culty shit, I can see where there's like these little nuggets of like
pop culture,
good-ish advice.
Yes.
Good-ish advice that people latch onto. Like, it's good to take your own inventory in all things in your life where you're like, well, that went bad. Like, what was my contribution to that? I can, you know what I'm saying? Like a 100%. Logical person. Yeah. We'll latch on to that. And then not this. Cause what they do is they have an exercise called the mirroring exercise. So In this exercise, you write down what's bothering you. So maybe you write down my twin flame isn't interested or my friend isn't calling me back. And you take that sentence and you replace the other person with yourself. So I'm not interested in me. I'm not communicating correctly. I'm not engaging correctly. That's mirroring.
It's really deep.
Everything that happens in your life, you replace with them, whatever they did to you, and replace it with yourself. I did this. It's totally rooted in shame.
100%.
Which keeps people vulnerable, which keeps people in the group.
100%.
Yeah, it's gross. Oh my God. So on top of, again, not respecting other people's boundaries, there's a whole lot of shame. And the university students are people who are clearly struggling. They're now, you know, because they participated in the first place, and now they're evaluating all the ways that they suck and why it's their fault that they can't find love. Yeah, it's so gross. In some instances, the person that Jeff and Shalia are telling them to pursue because they are their twin flame are toxic people. Like, there was one woman who was told that her ex-boyfriend was her twin flame, even though their previous relationship was toxic and the guy had issues and she didn't want to be with him, but they told her he was the one.
Yep.
And there was another young woman who was told that her twin flame was this dude who clearly had mental health issues. She was not attracted to him. She was actually scared of him, but she's in a relationship with him because they're telling her that he's the one and that they just need to make it work. So she's like trying to make it work.
And like, how do they fucking know? And how is it that every single one of them already has the twin flame in their life in some way, shape, or form? They just have to go get them.
Well, it starts that way, but then you're robbing my brain again. That's literally my next sentence. Then when this isn't working out exactly the way they need it to, they start to sort of graduate into telling people that their twin flame is another student who is in the university. It always is.
Uh-huh.
So now instead of you knowing that you have a soul connection with somebody because you're supposed to feel it and blah, 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 Jeff and Shalia know because they are all knowing.
Oh, because they're spiritually awakened and enlightened on a level that their students have not reached yet.
That's exactly right. Jeff and mm-hmm. Shalia are like, we're the experts and you need to do what you're told. So this is obviously difficult because here's the twin flame ideology. It says that this is gross, that every relationship, there has to be a divine masculine and a divine feminine.
This fucking bullshit.
And a woman can only embody her true femininity when she is with someone who embodies their true masculinity.
Oh, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm. So this becomes a problem because, again, now they're hand selecting only other students, which is predominantly women. So now Jeff and Shalia are claiming that each person's twin flame is, you know, fellow students, and they're encouraging people to be in same-sex relationships when they aren't gay. And then they actually use this to promote, like, they're a gay positive university. And people are like, but I'm not attracted to women. They're like, but that's your twin flame. So you have to.
What?
Yes. It just keeps getting weirder. Then in order to correct the divine masculine and divine feminine, they encourage one of the women in that same gender relationship to present as masculine, because there has to be a divine masculine and a divine feminine. And so now they're encouraging people to
change genders,
change genders. And they're even now like promoting themselves as trans positive group. It's all so fucked up. And people are like, I don't identify as a man. And they're even like, oh, hey, Becky, your name's Larry now.
What?
And she's like, I don't want to. And they're like, you have to.
Oh my God. What the fuck? This is insane.
It's so insane. Gross. It's so gross. Yep. What?
You can't.
Okay. So they're doing all this, pairing up, making people present as masculine so that it will work, right? And also within this university, it's very much like a pyramid, right? So there's coaches that work under Jeff and Shalia, and coaches are members who also have people that they're coaching and helping find their twin flames. And so all of this is people like in different parts of the world, and it's like Zoom school, right? So they make these really awkward Zoom calls to members. And this is all in the documentary. And it'll be like their coach and Jeff and Shalia, and they'll start the Zoom call and they'll be like, I have a surprise for you. We know who your twin flame is. And like they're on a call with Tiffany. And then all of a sudden, here comes like on the call, Rachel. And they're like, surprise, it's Rachel. And then Tiffany and Rachel are like, because they're not gay.
Right.
Oh, it's so... It gives me the tingles to watch.
No, this isn't just a cult. It's also an MLM.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. So they're both like, oh, okay. And like, what are they going to say? So then at this point, one of them, you know, needs to be masculine. And Jeff and Shalia will tell one of them that they need to present as a man, even if it doesn't feel right to them, because that's how it needs to be. And they're told that, look, I can tell because I'm the expert that your spirit is masculine. Mm-hmm. So
I'm starting to lose words at this point.
It's like backwards forced conversion.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Which is so fucking weird. So then Jeff starts referring to himself as the second coming of Christ.
Oh no.
And he's looking into acreage that he can buy so that they can have a compound with all the members.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Where they can birth and raise their children together and have a generation of golden children.
I'm sorry, what?
A generation of golden children.
Golden children.
Mm-hmm. Also, because the twin flame pairings are, you know, couples that can't naturally have children, they would be able to have children on the compound via sperm donation that was only approved by Jeff and Shalia.
And here's the thing. This shit always fucking escalates. It always fucking escalates. You know what I mean? It started out as a grift. It started out as an online grift.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now like moving towards a full like compound cult mm-hmm. situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Luckily that it didn't get to that. It hasn't happened yet. At the end of the documentary, Shalia announces that she is pregnant. Which is so terrifying to think of a baby being brought into that. As far as the legal troubles of some of the members who were stalking, they were left to figure it out on their own. The team of employees who were also members, they had coaches, a web team, a finance team, social media. They were never paid, even though it very quickly turned into a full-time job where they had to quit their jobs and they basically were required to make themselves available to Jeff and Shalia at all times. And they were just left with their own trauma to pick up their pieces on their own. I think there was definitely one woman who was taking hormones, and I believe she had a mastectomy. Like,
holy shit!
Yes. Yes. And Twin Flames Universe is still open and operating today.
No.
Yes, I went online and saw it. It's still there.
But they don't have a compound yet.
They never bought a compound.
Yet.
No. Nope. That is Twin Flames. Escaping Twin Flames documentary. Yeah. There was, in this documentary, the woman who kept calling the ex who got the restraining order and lost her job, like, he's leaving her voicemails and he's like, leave me the fuck alone. I'm not your soulmate. I'm not your twin flame. I'm not whatever this fucking shit is that you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, it was so bad.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine getting repeated phone calls from somebody who is like, you're my twin flame? No. No.
No. No. Like, regular stalking is bad enough. This is next level.
Next level. And then one of the women who went on to be paired up with a woman and was the masculine one, and she wasn't very happy about that. Initially, she was told that her twin flame was this guy that she worked with, who they were friends, but he was much, much, much younger than her and gay. And she kept persisting him. And he was like, leave me alone.
With somebody that she works with?
Yeah, they were friends. She was like 40 and he was like 20 something and fully gay and out. And she insisted that he was her twin flame. And he was like, leave me the fuck alone. Like, what? Yeah.
This is insane. I can't believe that these people have not been taken down yet.
I know. They are filthy. Internet,
get on that.
Yeah.
Get on it. We got to take these people down. I mean, well, this documentary exists. How do people not know this by now?
I don't know. I don't
Everybody
know.
Everybody be on the lookout for Twin Flame University. Jesus Christ. Well, sister, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
We did it.
We did it. We're on all the things. Go find us.
Go find us on all the things. Go write Become us a review on the Apple Podcast app. We really love that, as you can tell.
Join the club.
Join the club.
$5 a month gets you in the club.
We get a bonus episode every month. We have virtual wine nights every once in a while. And you get new episodes a day early. We drop them a day early for our kids club members. So do that.
Patreon.com/crime, wine, and chaos.
Sister, that was
so fucking
so chaotic.
Goodbye.
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.
By 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers.
Let me close out my list of shouty outies. God, I can't believe I'm actually this organized. Who am I right now?
I don't know.
It's a